Today is Monday, April the 10th, 2017. It is 9 a.m. This panel is number 1114, Building Livable Cities. That's for the record. If you want to get up and leave, you can now. So, all right. There's a few technical things. Lots of the programs are going to be using an app. It was determined this morning, after I was trained in using the app, that we're not going to use the app. We're going to go to the old school, and we're going to have a little 3x5 cards here. And we have two producers who are going around giving out the cards. If you want to raise your hand right now, they will give you a card, and if you write a question down, you'll be able to hold it up, and they'll go collecting them and bring them up to me. So we're going to go old school, not the app. But many of the sessions you have will have the app, and they'll have big signs on how to tie into the CWA app. So if you want a card, they're watching out for your hands, and they'll get to you. All right, that's another technical thing. This is Building Livable Cities, and the moderators have been asked to say a few words, keep it short, on their qualifications and background for being the moderator for this panel. As I said, my name is Richard Foy. I've had a design firm here in Boulder since 1971. We've designed hundreds of millions of square feet of projects in 40 countries and hundreds of cities, including I designed the Pearl Street Mall here in Boulder, 29th Street, Park Meadows, started the Farmers Market, and then nationally, some give you some idea of scope, I designed LA Live for Phil Anschutz. I did the O2 Dome in Berlin, O2 Dome in Greenwich, England, and lots of big projects, Tokyo Midtown, Bugis Junction, Singapore, so lots of big projects that are catalyst projects in their communities that all respond to the social, cultural, and economic desired outcomes of a community. So that's end of my bio. And we have some very, very interesting people and qualified people and diverse people that have gathered here. Let's see, how are we lined up? I'll start with this woman right here, April Rinney. I said that right. It's the first time I've said it. She is upside down all over the world. If you go to her website, she has photographed herself doing handstands, feet up, hands down. Almost every place that she goes, she does that. But it's sort of a metaphor from what I understand from her bio that she really goes into micro-lending and systems that make cities and people work better together in places. So that's a little bit on her. You'll find her fascinating. The next gentleman here is Eric Lindstrom. Eric is a nerd. He is a science nerd. He has his feet on the ground, but he's mostly, you know, in the water and his head in the clouds. So he studies the relationship between water and air and how it affects the whole earth. So without land, water, and air, you don't have cities. So he is a key person on this panel. Next, yes, is Liz Blake. She's a former executive with Fortune 500 companies that for the last, how many years, Liz, have you been with Habitat for Humanity?
10.
So she's been rushing off to places and helping people in need of housing and has a huge network of volunteers that find this work very, very fulfilling as it fulfills the lives of people who are receiving their largesse. That's Liz. And then last person is Andrew Heben?
Yeah.
Okay, Andrew. And he has become sort of a leader in a relatively new field of tiny houses and tent cities and addressing the needs of very affordable and rapidly realized communities that serve people who cannot afford the $1.1 million average cost of a house in Boulder, Colorado, because that's where we have gone in the opposite direction. So those are our panelists, and I'll just now turn it over to them, and there's going to be a little bit of an aside role for Liz, who we agreed that this is sort of an esoteric or a technical sounding thing. Building livable cities sounds like it's for developers, and Liz is going to give us a sort of an overview of what a livable city is to get us all warmed up.
Thank you, Richard, and good morning to everybody, and thank you for getting up so early. Appreciate it. I wouldn't presume that most of you don't know what a livable city is because you're all smart enough to be living in Denver. I mean Denver, in Boulder, which is even better than Denver. But there is buzz around the world about livable cities. And what I wanted to do was set a framework for it because livable cities has become a buzzword. There are areas of study. If you Google it, you'll find lots and lots of different areas. So to level set the discussion for today, but not to limit it, I wanted to give a little bit of background. Probably about 15 or 20 years ago, there was a trend of urbanization that started getting tracked by the World Bank and various parts of the UN and whatnot. And about 4 years ago, the world tipped so that it is now more urban than not urban. So they're in the world, around the world, thinking about it, more than 51% of the world now lives in cities. The climate change is going to have a huge ongoing impact on this. And the other thing that we don't really think about, but refugee situations and issues relating to natural disasters also accelerate urbanization. I've done a lot of work in Haiti, and the fourth largest city in Haiti was formed 7 years ago as a result of an earthquake. And it's the fourth largest city, but there's no water and sanitation, and there's no electricity, and there's no formal services. So this is a very, very important trend around the world. The leading organizations that track livable cities are The Economist, who looks at it from a business development perspective. Mercer, which we know from the HR world, they've actually done it from an HR and choosing business locator perspective. There's a really cool group called Numbeo, N-U-M-B-E-O, which is the only data that's collected by user contributors. So it's one of the most fabulous databases in the world, and it's people that go to cities that then gather data and pile it into this very interesting database. And then there's a group called Monocle that also does livable city data. All of them collect around certain criteria, and overall the criteria include crime and safety, climate, public transportation, tolerance and some other version of quality of life around the human experience, business conditions, health. Some include recreation and culture. Almost always there's a hygiene. Not all of them, but most of them also track education. And then there's various categories under goods and services. Probably the most authoritative study that's being done around cities is the Rockefeller Foundation. Judy Rodin, who's the outgoing head of Rockefeller, hired ARUP, A-R-U-P, about 10-15 years ago. And I hated that she did that because up to that point, Rockefeller was funding nonprofits. And they stopped funding nonprofits to fund cities. And they now have a project called the 100 Resilient Cities. And if you go on their website, you can see the round diagram of how they deal with livable cities. And they've got quite a good set of criteria. But they look at it through four dimensions, 12 drivers, and 7 qualities. And they have 100 cities that they're funding. And the good thing about it is they're funding them interacting with each other. From my perspective, the most important part about focusing on livable cities is to realize, the other folks tracking livable cities are all the work that has been done around the Sustainable Development Goals, which I know you all have heard about, and Quito and Habitat 3, which were the efforts by the United Nations to look again at the way the world was and the world governments were measuring themselves. And from this is something called the NUA, which is the New Urban Agenda. And for those of us that have worked in housing for a long time, it's great to have this focus of the resilient cities, the Rockefellers, and NUA, for example, because for the first time, data related to housing and the land for housing and the environmental impact of housing and whatnot is finally being measured. There's also a gender impact. And from the NUA, there's a subgroup that's called the Right to the City. From my perspective, because of the ongoing vulnerability that we have to natural disasters, and because of the vulnerability of certain populations, including youth, women, and the elderly, in an urbanizing world, it's wonderful that we are focusing on livable cities. So thank you very much for being here to learn and to talk about livable cities.
Let me mention also that this program or this session panel is advertised as a round table. Now you can see the table is not round, but that means that it's not a sequential thing where one panelist follows the next, and then there's rebuttals and so forth. It's sort of an open discussion among these people. And again, in a round table, I think that if you want to ask a question, put your hand up. They'll come and get your card, our producers, and they'll bring it up to me, and we can ask questions. I'll pace it so they don't get flooded with questions during the whole thing, so it's not just at the end. And if you do, once I read the question, you need to come up to the mic, that mic over there, and then you'll have your chance to ask a question. And I've also been warned to not let people grandstand. A question is what or why or how or something like that. It's not when I went to school and 10 minutes later you get around to a question if they ever remembered what the question was. So I'm going to be pretty good about monitoring that. Okay, so now it's open for our panelists to engage and do their brainstorm.
Looking towards me? So I guess I could just do a little introduction and thinking about livable cities. What came to mind for me was creating a city that's accessible and sustainable to all of its inhabitants, where average citizens can come together through democratic process and have a hand in shaping their cities. And so I have a background in housing, and so to me a pretty large component of that is creating access to a decent and affordable place to live for everybody, because without that, it's hard to create a livable city when we have people on the streets. We see the negative externalities of that every day, costs through policing, courts, jails, emergency rooms. There's plenty of studies coming out that show leaving a person on the street can cost $40,000 to $60,000 per person per year. And we're seeing a housing first policy in response to that. And so I work with a nonprofit called Square One Villages, and we're kind of responding to the absence of action from federal and state level. We have a huge deficit in terms of the amount of need for affordable housing and the amount of funding supplied. And so we're trying to come up with ways that a local community can respond to this issue by utilizing the resources within the local community. And so really, I think people, basically we build tiny house communities, and that's a way that a local community can come together and build housing for folks, both transitional and affordable. And a lot of people are fascinated by the physical structures, but I think our work is focused more on bringing people together. So they're projects that many of you in this room could participate in and help directly provide housing, which I think is a unique thing. So I think building access to decent, affordable housing is a pretty important part of a livable city. But beyond that physical aspect, I think there's also the social aspect. So we also have to think about building neighborhoods and building communities. So we're not just building tiny houses scattered around the city, but we're building clusters of them. We're allowing people that are living there to have a say in how their community is managed, and we've seen a lot of positive results because people take ownership when they're given a chance to have a say in the place of where they live. So that's kind of the economic and the social aspects. And then I guess also environmentally of the tiny house, you know, reducing the footprint. So I guess, you know, there's also obviously issues of climate change and the need to reduce our footprint. And so I'm also looking at issues of how can we reduce our environmental footprint. So that's kind of a brief introduction.
So I probably am a good segue from Andrew's comments. Delighted to be here. Welcome, everybody. And to put some of what Liz and Andrew said in context, so Liz mentioned that we're now at 51% urban. If we look to the future, today we have a population of roughly 7 billion, just over 7 billion people, just over half of whom are urban. By 2030, that number is expected to be 8 billion people, 65% of whom will be urban. By 2050, that number is 9 billion people, 75% of whom are urban. And by 2100, which I admit probably not all of us in this room will remember, but our kids will be alive at this time, 10 billion people, 85% of whom are urban. That means far more people who live in cities within one century than inhabit the entire planet today. So just kind of level set, it's almost hard to get your head around that. Now, when I look at that, I think, okay, you know, that, and that's short of some kind of climate disaster or whatnot, which is eminently possible. But if we think about what it means to live in a city and to have connections in cities and have a high quality of life, we can't just keep cramming people and things into cities. It's like, at a certain point, you're compromising the quality of life. And we need only to look at some of the megacities in the world to see what that means. And so my whole career has focused really on inclusive business. How do we build business that works better and for more people? And as Richard mentioned, I spent many years in microfinance. You can think of that as a way to help more people meet their needs. And for the last several years, I've been focusing on this space called the sharing economy, or the collaborative economy, if you've heard of that. But basically looking at business models focused on access rather than ownership. And, you know, a lot of what Andrew's doing, it's about how do we help more people access what they need by looking at things from a smaller scale, if you will. I'm looking at this across all sectors, whether it's housing, whether it's co-working spaces, whether it's shared use transportation, whether it's skill sharing, the list goes on and on and on, and we can easily talk about that more. But I end up working with a lot of cities and city governments around the world. So I am based in Portland, Oregon, but last year I worked in 22 countries on 5 continents. Developed markets, emerging markets, you name it. All of them are really interested in this concept of the sharing economy to help them think about how can we build more livable cities. And by that I say these are more sustainable cities, more resilient cities, smarter cities. But at the end of the day, it's really about that human connection, that we can have all kinds of technology in cities and smart cities that help us run cities more efficiently, but those could still be miserable places to live. How do we ensure that we maintain human connections amidst all of that? And one of the statistics I like to think about is if you put one car into shared use, you take somewhere, depends on the place, but you take somewhere between 9 and 15 cars off the road. Now imagine that in the city context. You've just cut your traffic and congestion by 90%. These are really simple solutions, but culturally often hard to implement and require more of a mindset shift than anything. So I get excited. Basically, I go around the world and help city governments and startups and other companies think through how to harness the sharing economy to help meet some of these goals. And I really see it as a tool to build more livable, but also more connected, sustainable, resilient cities. So thank you.
Thanks, April. So my work has nothing to do with cities. I'm an oceanographer. I work at NASA headquarters, and for half my career I was a seagoing oceanographer and spent a couple of years at sea, not near any cities at all. We have our own little city on a ship. And then I got beamed up to work at NASA headquarters in oceanography from space. So really, what I feel like I bring to this, there are a couple of questions that were sort of burning for me as I look around at what is a livable city. you can go with The Economist and maybe the Rockefeller, and they look at big cities and the quality of life in those cities, but that seems like a completely different measure than if you open Outside Magazine and they tell you the, you know, what's the best place to live in the United States. They're looking at small cities and communities, and they're completely seem like the same measure being used in completely different ways. So is Tokyo the most livable city, or is it Portland or Boulder? Or, you know, the scale seems to matter a lot. And then about measuring livability, I think that we need to figure out how much we should discount livability against current and future threats, climate change, weather changes, water availability, food security, transportation can be measured now. I know Washington, D.C. has had a great metro system when it was built, built the city around it, but if you don't maintain it, it then becomes a liability and people say, oh, I don't want to use the metro anymore. So they're struggling to recover things that were really good qualities of a city that weren't maintained well. So these snapshots of livability, how much, how stable are they really? And how do we build that into giving people an assessment of what needs to be done? So I don't know whether I can, I'm no expert on cities. I thought that I would like to stimulate the panel to try and educate me and you about what livability really means and how do we build it so that it's sustainable.
Andrew, do you have any numbers of how many people live, percentage of U.S. population, for example, or world population, living close to the ocean or on the ocean? And those cities are quite at risk with
Eric,
the change. I meant yes,
Eric.
That's good. Eric. So
so
population wise.
So the numbers, you know, vary, but 50% of people tend to want to move towards close to the coast. So coasts are a popular place to be. But they bring with them additional threats of sea level rise. We already have cities that are dealing with sea level rise problems, like Miami and Norfolk, Virginia, and New Orleans. And so these aren't distant future threats. These are today threats.
It's Manhattan, too. Yeah. Lower Manhattan. Okay. Go on.
I'd like to add to the question that Eric asked of what makes a city livable, what it is about bringing about change that can make a city become more livable or prevent a city from becoming unlivable. I am a lawyer by training, so forgive me for that, but I think through systems solutions, and I know that the greatest risk of urbanization beyond risk to the climate is the risk to the poor. So on the risk to the climate, to echo what Eric said, one of my colleagues at Habitat International is now working in Liberia to do a major relocation of three of the largest slums in the capital city. Because within 15 years, those slums will be underwater. And it's not, it's completely inevitable. Nobody's controverting it. And yet, like the people who live in Guatemala City on a garbage dump, the same in Phnom Penh on a garbage dump, these are thrown away and forgotten people. Habitat works around those vulnerable populations and is now being forced to focus on those vulnerable populations where it is the intersection of the overcrowding and the vulnerability from an environmental risk. The interesting lesson from that, though, is I was in outside Manila on the Pascaway River, and the river is not quite as wide as this room, and yet if you look across it, it looks like a solid piece of land because there's so much garbage floating on the top of it. that you cannot, literally, you cannot see the water. And Habitat worked to relocate the people from this area. The pollution was unspeakable, disease, children dying, children falling in the river and floating away, unspeakable. And we moved hundreds and hundreds of people to these beautiful little houses. They worked to construct them because Habitat doesn't like giving things away. They work with people to teach them how to build houses. And the project in its initial phase was completely a failure. And it was because the people lived in this, to us, very difficult environment because it was close to family and, more importantly, close to their livelihoods. So we moved them to a place where there wasn't as easy access to their livelihoods, and they'd rather live in squalor but have a job and be able to provide for their families. So when you think about the what makes it sustainable, when we look here, we talk about sustainability in terms of recreation and whatnot. In the developing world, where most of the vulnerable populations are being urbanized, they don't have clean water. They don't have jobs. They don't have rights to their land. And so the needs are way, way more fundamental. But if you don't look at their experience and work in the livability in the context of having a decent, safe place, as well as access to livelihood and water and sanitation, you might as well not do the intervention. In addition, if you do things to people in your urban planning, and the best urban planners don't intend to do things to people, they want to do things for people. But unless there's truly meaningful engagement of the population, you will end up doing things too, with your best intention. You may think, but unless you actually do things with the voice of the community effectively engaged in the planning of their own future, you will have people fighting whatever the positive change is that, that you indicate. And I'll give one quick story on that and then seed, which is, in Haiti, right after the earthquake, we were working in an area called Simon Palais, and we finally got enough money after doing this democratic work with the community to do some upgrading. And we got some World Bank money for upgrading. And I was sure, because I had been in this slum many times, that they would put their first dollar into covering the open sewer slums. You know, if you're in an open sewer area, you think that's the one. And the first grant we got, they said, no, we don't want to cover the sewers. We want solar lights. And I thought, solar lights? And they said, no, you have to give us solar lights. And we did what they said. And I'm thinking, I'm so smart. These guys are going to really wish they'd covered their sewers. And it was because people were living in tent cities, many of them orphans, many of them child-headed households, many of them girl child-headed households. And the girls were getting raped so often because the tents were being sliced open that the only way to stop the violence against the most vulnerable was to put solar lights so the perps couldn't rape the girls at night. And that was more important to the community. And, you know, shame on us for thinking that we know, because we don't.
Okay, everyone got a first round in, and I'm getting inundated by questions. So we're going to do a quick fire. I'm going to read them, and then whoever wants to take the question, unless it's directed, give an answer as brief but as thorough as you can. First question is, what happened to slow the population growth of the 1970s? Slow growth, population as a way of maintaining and quality of life.
I don't know that any one of us are actually population experts on this panel. I can chime in a little bit that if you look globally, the numbers that I just threw out, I actually should put a couple, massage those a little bit more, in that if you look globally, yes, there are countries where we now have negative population growth. Japan and Italy are great examples. Japan has 120 million people today. If everything plays out as expected, by 2080, they will have 65 million people. The population of Japan is slated to halve within the next 60, 70 years. That's not due to any particular government policy like China with the one-child policy, but nonetheless, we're seeing an aging of populations as the baby boomers basically grow up, retire, pass on. Their children are not having as many children. So many of the developed world, I would say the populations are decreasing. The numbers I stated to you, and I don't have the exact percentage, but the overwhelming percentage of the growth in urbanization will be in developing and emerging markets. So the kinds of populations and cities that Liz is talking about. So I kind of want to call that out because it's actually a compounding of that problem. So net, I mean, and we still have many countries where the birth rate has gone down, but many countries in Western, Central, Southern Africa where the average birth rate is still 5-6 children per woman. Many other countries, it's under one. So we really have to kind of, the globe and the population just doesn't look the same in terms of disbursement and how the pieces fit together. But overall, we are still growing as a population, and I don't think that having a global population that was decreasing, that I suppose is in the cards, but that would require a mammoth effort that I'm not sure has ever been growing, but getting it to a sustainable level of growth. And depending on who you talk to, I know I've seen people who think 8 billion people is a sustainable level or steady state, 10 billion, no one really knows, but we are getting, you know, given the consumption and environmental footprints of each individual, we are getting closer to reaching that point. Because as all of us know, or I'm assuming most of us know, like the more economically successful you are, the more things you're able to buy, the bigger your carbon footprint, and the more, you know, at that point, depending on carbon footprints, we can sustain a smaller population vis-a-vis having more people who have less access to basic goods and services, meaning that their environmental footprint is lower. So
okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Good answer.
Okay.
Just a footnote to that, I don't think there's one European country that is reproducing itself. To do that, you have to have a birth rate of 2.1 per couple. Below that, you're not reproducing. That's Europe is one of the things that the immigration is because of jobs, because Europe needs workers to sustain their economies and to support the retired people, because there's not enough young people to hold those jobs. Next question, how does the homeless population fit into the livable cities concept?
How does the homeless population fit into the livable cities concept? I think it's a very visible example of how we're failing to create a livable city, and I think it's something that needs to be addressed. I think from my perspective, so I did my thesis project on tent cities. I went and stayed in some homeless encampments throughout the country and learned about them. And while the physical conditions were unideal, I found a lot of positive social dynamics. There was direct democracy happening. People were coming together to have meetings to decide how their community would be managed. There were committees that were elected so that you maintained a safe and sanitary camp, and really transitioned to this idea of a tiny house village, which you guys are probably familiar with. The tiny house is also a popular concept coming down from these really nice things that you see maybe on HGTV, where it's you know, sort of a novelty item that people are building in their backyards. But I really think these tent cities are sort of pioneering a vision for a more sustainable future. A lot of these folks, not to romanticize the issue, but in our Opportunity Village project, in our Emerald Village project that's about to open, there's a lot of people that are content with living with less, and they have a small amount of income through supplemental security income, part-time work, and you know, they're okay with a small space of their own. And you know, there's common at Opportunity Village, which is, you know, the simpler version of one of our projects. You know, it's basically a detached bedroom, and then there's a common bathroom, common kitchen, and a common living room with computers, and they have a weekly meeting there. And I think a lot of people are attracted to this concept that aren't constrained by income. So we're about to break ground on our Emerald Village project, which will be permanent tiny houses on slab foundation. They'll have a bathroom and a kitchen in each unit, 160 to 300 square feet. So starting to get to the concept of a normal, typical home, only on a smaller scale. And we're building this project to serve people with very low incomes, but we're having people apply that aren't even necessarily constrained by income because they're just interested in this this concept of having a small space of your own and having that supported by larger common spaces where you can talk to your neighbors, and it just seems more appealing than this single family development where you're each on your own island and you might not have a connection to your neighbors. And I think, you know, this is all rooted back to like dynamics that were observed in the tent city and the way that people got along and helped their neighbors, and people that had very little would give to each other. People in a similar situation trying to work together to improve each other's situation. So,
okay, next question. I think this is directed to you, April. Can you give a couple of examples of access versus ownership?
Sure, and sorry about that. I apologize, when I did my introduction, I sort of glossed over the whole sharing economy. How many of you have heard that term, sharing economy? Okay, good, that's super. I define the sharing economy broadly as an economy based on access over ownership and decentralized networks of people connected through new technologies. So if we think about historically, and certainly over the last 100 years, we've really built, and post-World War II, let's say, we've built an economy based on production, consumption, produce, like we measure by GDP, and that's how we're growing, and that's how we know the economy is healthy. I will leave aside the conversation around how GDP is actually a really bad metric to measure the health of an economy. That might be another panel. But the point being, part of the production-consumption system and mindset is everybody owns their stuff. Like, I have my house, I have my car, I have my bicycle, I have my clothes, and so on and so forth. And you do the same, and you do the same, and you do the same. And that was very easy. It's very easy to measure from a produce-consume mentality. And I don't mean to be knocking that. That actually led to many decades of prosperity and so on and so forth. But we're starting to realize, I think collectively, some of the downsides of that way of thinking. Number one, that is a very expensive model to maintain. I have to own everything. I have to maintain everything. Same for you and you and you. Environmentally, this is just incredibly resource intensive, especially when we look at the fact that, for example, as many of you probably know, a car is driven on average 1 hour a day, 23 hours a day. 95% of the time your car is parked completely unused. That is a massively inefficient asset. And third, building on what we've just been talking about, one of the really interesting and sad results of this ownership mentality is that when I own all of my things and my toys and my castle, if you will, and you do and you do and you do, I don't actually need to know my neighbors. I don't need to borrow a cup of sugar. I don't need to borrow a lawnmower. I don't need to do any of this. And so it's led to a lot of isolation and loss of community in many places. And so the sharing economy as a concept starts to hack away at some of those downsides. It's more, if you think about sharing rather than owning, and here I'll say access rather than own. So to be able to access some of the things, I can access a car when I need it as opposed to needing to own it all the time. I can tap into office space when I need it as opposed to having to pay for the overhead of an office full time year round. Again, just a nice statistic. The typical office is occupied 60% of the time during workplace hours. And it costs on average here in the US about $1,000 a month to maintain. It's crazy. It's just money down the drain, and it's also, again, a heavier environmental footprint than needed. So when we say access over ownership, that's what I'm talking about. And if you think about if you can share or access some of the things that you need in your life rather than having to own them all the time, you save money. In some cases, you can earn income. We can talk about that separately. But if you think about Airbnb, many of you know Airbnb, if you're able to rent out or share a room in your home, you're earning income based on an asset that you've already had. Nothing really else about your lifestyle has to change, and lo and behold, you actually have more disposable income at the end of the month. You're consuming fewer natural resources, and you're building, in many cases, you're building community. So access over ownership is when you're accessing an asset as opposed to having to own it outright. And I should mention a lot of this, not all of it, but a lot of this is enabled by this. So the modern sharing economy and a lot of the work that I do with governments is like they just still can't get their head around the fact that I can find pretty much anything I need through my phone. Now, some of you might not be doing that, but like younger generation, like this is everything. This is my access point to pretty much information, cars, friends, you name it. And it gets really interesting in terms of from a regulatory perspective and so forth. But But that's the world we're moving into. There are a lot of people who think that a generation from now, on average, whether you're rich or poor, you're quite likely to own less. And hopefully, if we can, the better technology gets at being able to manage the flows of these assets so that I can access what I need. The technology is helping us know who needs what when. It actually becomes more seamless, more frictionless, more efficient, such that you will have, again, whether you're rich or poor, you'll be opting in to access something as opposed to thinking that you need to own it for any kind of social status reasons and otherwise. I'll stop there. But
although we drive a car 1 hour a week, when you add the waxing, washing, loving, reading about it, and writing songs about the car, it adds up to more hours.
That's true. And if I can, in the context of global development, one of my most memorable insights where I had that sort of wake-up call, I've worked a lot in emerging markets, and I worked for many years in India. And one day I was with one of my colleagues in India going on and on about, again, exactly this, sharing, and thinking about, from a global development megacities perspective, many of these, so cities like Delhi or Mumbai or Johannesburg, you have in many cases a pre-ownership society in that most people don't yet, or many people don't yet own a car, right? And car from a development perspective, it's like once you have a car, you're like, you're no longer poor, for sure. You're on the way up. You're part of the emerging middle class. And I was going on about, wouldn't it be amazing if you think about the fact that in Mumbai, I know people who have truly 3.5 hour daily commutes in Mumbai because of the traffic, not distance, traffic. Like, well, wouldn't it be great if we could think about potentially going from a pre-ownership society to kind of being able to leapfrog all of the muckety muck of ownership and get to the point where the population of Mumbai can actually tap into car sharing and ride sharing opportunities much more quickly. And he looked at me and he said, wait a minute, just hold on. I am a member of this emerging middle class. I will be the first in my family to ever own a car. Let me just tell you that if I can afford to buy a car and I can afford to park that car outside of my house and have it sit there for 23 hours a day, and my neighbors can see that I have a car and it's sitting outside of my house 23 hours a day, he's like, that's not a wasted investment. That's the best investment I can make. But it was about, and I don't know, dignity?
Identity.
It was about identity. It was about having made it. And I realized right then and there that we do have a much bigger problem globally, and it's as much a cultural mindset shift as it is any kind of economic modeling.
Here's a sort of an add-on question to that. Since 2008, when even ownership became rental through increased property tax, through hyperinflated housing value, how can you, April, postulate that rental is superior to ownership?
I don't want to say that it's superior in fear. I don't try to convert people in my work. I try to help people understand there's a much, much broader menu of options available. There's a universe of different kinds of lifestyles that people can create. And I think a lot of times I hear about what Andrew's saying, where what people are opting into and what matters most is no longer having a big house, is no longer having multiple cars. It's about actually being able to, and sometimes it's by choice, and sometimes it's the economic pressures of, as we look at what's happening to jobs in the workplace and, you know, the end of lifetime employment and that sort of thing. So we can have a conversation around prices of real estate, which I think is probably a separate conversation and not necessarily my area of expertise. But when I'm looking at renting rather than owning, I do not think we're all moving to a world in which everything is rented or shared and not owned. I still own a lot of things. For a lot of people, and I think I agree, having access to secure housing for a lifetime, that is much more important to me than knowing whether or not somebody owns one home and pays down their mortgage over 30 years.
So can I interrupt for
please,
just a sec, which is to say, to get to the Habitat model that I'm so blessed to have some association with, if someone owns a home, there is the breaking of the cycle of poverty permanently for that usually single mom with her kids and for that generation that follows. So there's a difference between the, and I know our moderator hates resilience, he likes resourcefulness better, but there is an aspect to ownership that's very important in the accumulation of wealth that enables you to be resilient against whatever it is. And when you see a woman who, with her kids, for the first time, has a place where she can close the door and it is hers, and her, I will tell you, her kids will go to college. Her kids, I've been on build sites where somebody said, I grew up in a Habitat house and I'm now at Duke Law School. I mean, you just don't get that in a rental. And the other thing is, in cities where education is so important and how getting out of poverty is so important, it's a reality that most kids in the lower income, 30% AMI and below, go to 3 to 4 schools a year because their parents are renting, they get the deposit, they can't make the next payment, they get evicted. It's a cycle, and you cannot get educated if you are a transient student. So there's something to be said for building a society that enables people to have that home ownership for resilience and education.
Here's another. There's a ton of questions on homelessness, tons. So I'll try to get to a representative example, but I'm going to try and get to some other topics, so we're covering a broader field. Is sustainability possible without democracy and social justice?
I don't know. Democratic process is a central piece to my work, and I think it's a reason why it has broken down a lot of the common stereotypes around homelessness. A lot of people think allowing 30 otherwise homeless people to gather and live on a place, on a piece of land, would result in lawlessness or increase in crime and violence. But because you give them democratic process and a say in how their communities operate and managed, they take pride and ownership over that place, even if they don't own it. So that's an interesting observation I've had, is that there's no financial ownership in our Opportunity Village model, but people still care for it because, you know, they're given this place to live and they're responsible for it. They do 10 hours a week to maintain it, and a number of other things. And I also think, to the rental versus ownership model, I've been looking into a lot more. I think that there's in between answers to that. So like cooperatives or community land trusts are examples in between those two that kind of merge the benefits of that. And so we're doing our next project, Emerald Village, which is permanent housing as a cooperative, where people won't own their individual home, but they'll accrue a share in the village. They'll have security of tenure, and they'll have a say in how their community is operated and managed. So you have a lot of benefits of home ownership without maybe some of the financial access restrictions.
So my answer would be no, it's not possible. And it's because people need to take care of themselves. It needs to be self-direction within a community. And if the community has, whether it's collective ownership or a series of individual ownerships, that is the fundamental basis of a sustainable community or society. I think without that kind of democratic participation and the voice of the community, including most people, if not all, I don't think it's sustainable.
Stay there, Liz. Here's one directed to you. Oh, do you have
I'd counterpoint a little bit. And seeing the tragedy of the commons, you know, how do we care for our air, our water? Democracy is not the best way necessarily of caring for the global commons. Sometimes benign dictatorship is a lot more effective.
Okay. Liz, here's one directed to you. We have the same situation in Boulder as you described in Manila. The low-income service workers in Boulder lose their connection to their families because they can't afford to live here and waste time and productivity out of commuting. How to solve this problem in the context of the USA?
No, that's an easy one. The answer is, I think, a combination of the things that we've been talking about here, which is there needs to be a change. There needs to be the political will in the United States and I believe it needs to be done on a locality-by-locality basis, of having the political will to make affordable housing available within a reasonable commute for the workers that are providing the work. If you look at, Andrew was talking about the smaller houses and the community land trust, there are lots and lots of tools that are available, but what is lacking most of the time, if you see people that have the three-hour commute and the terrible transit system, and they're still living in pretty terrible conditions far away, it's because there is not a political will. There's a NIMBY. They're not in my backyard. I don't want the homeless people. I don't want the working class people near me. And unless there's a commitment to affordable housing, there will continue to be this blight. I think the most difficult part of it is that our economy is getting more and more polarized. And I'm not talking about the political parts of it, but it's the rich and poor disparity is greater and greater. And unless people who are custodians of urbanizing areas, unless they make thoughtful places for workers and are intentional about it, the problem's going to get exacerbated. The solution to that, and Atlanta, there was a wonderful woman who's still a force of nature named Renee Glover, and she decided that Section 8 housing in Atlanta, this goes back 25 or 30 years, should not be replaced by Section 8 housing. It should be replaced by mixed income, mixed use communities. And what she did was pioneered the idea of not having low income slums, even a Habitat slum, but not having Section 8 slums, but replacing it by having affordability set-asides. So 15 to 20, if somebody, developer's coming in and they are putting in something, they're getting a tax concession, they're part of the growing economy, they need to make 15 to 25% of the units permanently affordable. And that's a policy in the communities that do it. It's making a difference. The other issue that we haven't talked about that rears its ugly head and I'm working on in Atlanta now is gentrification, the old terrible G word, gentrification. And they're actually literally now billboards in Atlanta that say, if you're black, you will no longer be able to live in the city of Atlanta. And these are billboards. And the truth of the matter is that as the city gets more and more urban and re-urbanized by, we're called blancs in Haiti, you know, by the white people, the rich people, the moneyed people, there is a reclaiming of the area and the gentrification, which then forces people out. It's possible not to gentrify, but you have to be intentional about it, and you have to have the political will, and we're actually working on an interesting project in Atlanta to pioneer not gentrifying a community turnaround, but it's political will more than anything, I think.
I'm just curious, and I want to be a bit of a provocateur. How many of you, if you found out that there was a low-income housing, maybe mixed use, but low-income housing development going up at the end of your block, how many of you would support that?
This is Boulder.
And how many of you would support a tax specifically to fund? Support a tax specifically to fund homeless? Okay, and I know we're in Boulder, but I'm curious because these are the sort I see NIMBYism all over the place, including often in the wealthiest. But like that sense that this is not the problem of the homeless. This is the collective responsibility for each and every one of us. And those of us who are fortunate enough to own our homes or whatever it may be, have a responsibility to, I'm going to say, give up some of that benefit to help those who need to actually become more integrated into our communities. And also understand that, and I think about the work that I've done, like the UK, you have rich social housing, community housing, public housing, and wealthy housing are so much more mixed there. You have everything on a given city block. And I think that actually has proven itself to be more resourceful, resilient over time. And so I think we really have to be bold and each one of us be ready to pony up some of our own our own resources and put some of our own hang-ups at the door for this to really change.
Here's another one. In Sunday, and this is from Jerry Bunce. He put his name on here, so I thought I should read it. In Sunday, New York Times article argued that Main Street, quote-unquote, with local stores cannot work in a global national economy. Only rich college towns have success by paying more for goods. Please address. If no one wants to take it, then we'll move on to the next question. But okay.
It's a good question. I don't know that it's anyone's.
Wait. If you want to.
Can you read the question again?
Yeah. In the Sunday New York Times article, it was argued that Main Street with local stores cannot work in a global national economy. Only rich college towns have success by paying more for goods.
Well, I'd suggest that people aren't paying more for goods just for goods. They're paying for the proximity. They're paying for the quality of the shopping experience. This I hate to admit out loud, but my husband was with Home Depot for a really long time, and they put I love hardware stores. They put them out of business all around around the country, and Mexico and Canada. But it's a question of the trade-off of the price benefit that we get versus the quality of life of going to Gerstein's hardware store. And I do think rich college towns and other places choose to have and support local economies. I think that's a wonderful thing, but I don't know.
Since you mentioned Home Depot, the CEO of Home Depot has stated that 85% of their sales are determined by women. Yes, women give the go-ahead to go get that tool or build this or remodel that, and women are the determiners of Home Depot's success.
So that question prompted me to think, well, why don't we invest in education in all of the towns and make all the towns college towns?
All right.
Good point. All right, here's one. Cities and their governors tend to be overwhelmed by multiple problems. What would you say are the top priorities for American cities?
Well, cities will say crime is the number one. Cities will say education is the number two. Cities sometimes pay lip service to urban planning and housing. Some cities will say transit is an issue. I'd be interested to know the answer to how cities actually spend their money, because actions show the dominant motive, and my guess is that most cities don't spend according to what they say their priorities are.
Here's another question. Do tiny house cities segregate cities based on income? Should integrating people of different incomes be a priority? Does a fear of density make American cities unaffordable?
Well, I think there's a few in there, but can you read the first question?
The first one was, do tiny house cities segregate cities based on income?
I don't think they have to. As I was saying before, I think there's broad interest. I see it. So I wrote a book called Tent City Urbanism, From Self-Organized Camps to Tiny House Villages. And what really attracted me to the model was that this was a way to blur the line between the housed and the unhoused. The tiny house presents an opportunity for people living in a tent to upsize and drastically improve their situation. But there's also growing interest in the tiny house movement of people wanting to downsize and move into a smaller unit. So I see this. So I guess what we've seen is that we've been able to open the door to these smaller scale developments. You know, our building codes and our zoning codes aren't written to these types of developments, and so we've had to put a lot of work into making them happen. And I think the reason that the local governments that have made them happen have had an interest in it is the social value of addressing homelessness and affordable housing. But I think once we see some of these pilot projects up and successful, there's already people I know that I'm in conversation with that are interested in doing market rate tiny house developments in Eugene and Portland and other cities. And so I see, like, in my long-term picture, I'd love to build a tiny house village that is a mixed income development as well.
Okay. How about, does fear of density make American cities unaffordable?
I think it makes it really hard to build affordable housing. I think NIMBYism is clearly the biggest obstacle to building housing, and typically the concern there is that, you know, so we're just, Cottage Grove is a town 30 minutes south of Eugene, a rural area, so we got a grant to replicate this model in a rural area, a smaller town with fewer resources. We're putting 13 tiny houses on a single family lot, and yeah, people are upset about density. So it is definitely a barrier, and yeah.
How do we ensure that lower income level people have a stake in the city?
How do we ensure that lower income people have a stake in the city? I guess it starts by giving them a place to be, leaving people homeless. I think we make a lot of judgments about homeless people based on their existing condition, and they have no stake in the city. They're forced to live their entire lives in the public realm. They'd have no conception of privacy to a large degree. And so to have a stake in the city, I think it starts by giving everybody in a city a legal place to be.
So now I just want to, we went through a slug of questions. There's lots more, but I want to give you reflection time if there's any thoughts that you've had that you want to share with people. I think without reference to a specific question, do you want to take the mic if you have something to say?
I had a footnote to Andrew's points just now. And I am a big fan of tiny homes and anything that allow those solutions that make a lot of sense and allow more people to, again, meet their needs in ways that work for them. I think, though, another way, and this is more the work that I've been doing with bigger cities, another way to just get more housing stock is to build up, right? So, and I know in many cities, and we can talk about San Francisco in this case, right? Huge access to affordable housing issue there. The rules on the books today in many neighborhoods say you can only build up to 3 stories or up to 6 stories. So right there, it's like, well, okay, we're not advocating for 60-foot skyscrapers, but there's a big difference between a building that's two floors or three floors, and 6 floors. So that's another, like, common sense. There's a lot of policy reform that needs to happen in this space as well. And then this is kind of a footnote on that. Then I work in some cities that are all skyscrapers, and Seoul, South Korea comes to mind as one of the most innovative, forward-thinking cities around livability. And it's a mega city of 25 million people that 2 generations ago, practically speaking, was kind of a backwater village. I mean, it was a city, but nothing like what it is today. And the mayor there, his name is Park Won-soon. He's known as the people's mayor. He was a human rights advocate before. Now he manages a city of 25 million people. I'm on an advisory board for the city and talking to them about what livability means. For him, and they're quite big advocates of the sharing economy, and I figured this was so that they could sell more Samsung devices and, you know, all that. And I sat down and said, why are you such an advocate of, again, access over ownership? And he said, you know, if it helps build our economy, great. If it's better for the environment, great. He said, but in this space, so many people have moved in from villages to the city, we've lost that sense of community. And he said, this is almost a direct quote, but he said, if we get the community piece right, the economics and the environmental benefits will flow, and they will automatically. He said, if we don't get the community piece right, nothing else matters. And they've done programs like a new law on the books. Doesn't matter how high your skyscraper is, if it's 2 floors or 60 floors, the number of parking spaces you are allocated is zero. Now, they're like, figure it out, you know? And they're moving towards a future in which, again, home ownership may well be a goal, but from a transit perspective, they're like, we want every car in this city to be shared in some way. Shared ownership, shared access, whatever. But, you know, that's a little bit of a carrot, a little bit of a stick, but just kind of wanted to add that as a footnote, but also think about some cities are doing some pretty awesome stuff to become deliberate. Many cities are actually doing a lot to become more livable. But the challenge, I think, is much more in the emerging and developing megacity context, where we don't have that infrastructure, we don't necessarily have that leadership or that political will.
So I'd like to tell another city story. You inspired me, April. Medellin. Has anybody been to Medellin, Colombia? Okay, well, I grew up in the era, dating myself, of marijuana and all the good drugs came from Medellin. It was the cocaine capital of the world, and it was the most dangerous city. For a long time, it was the most dangerous city in the world. And as soon as I can, I'm going to go back and spend another week there. And it is the most remarkable city ever. And part of it is that Pablo Escobar, who was the drug lord, was also a bit of a populist, and he put out a vision 25 years ago of Medellin without slums. And he even got himself elected to city council, you know, only in Colombia. he eventually went to jail, and he didn't end up being the godfather of the solution, but there was a series of progressive mayors, and it was a series of mayors and business guys who got together and said, we're going to make change. Urban regeneration is possible. But they started with the comunas, which is the slums. And in most cities, the slums are down low. In Brazil and in Colombia, the slums are up high, and you know, landslides, the babies fall down the hill instead of floating away. I mean, it's amazing. But in Medellin, the people would come from the comunas up top. They would go down the hill into the valley where they would work, and they would get robbed on the way back up. So shaken down, you know, whatever. The gangs lived in the middle. And so the city fathers, in putting this together, had imagination sessions in this community participatory thing with the people, imagination sessions. And the people said, it would be so great to be able to go to work and then not get robbed on the way back. And you kind of want to go, oh, okay. So what they did was they built two things. One was a 385-meter escalator. And it's the most remarkable thing to see. You know, zzz up the hill. And then the second thing they did was they built a cable car so that people could go to their job, jump over the gangs, and get up. And at the top, in this where these comunas are, there is the most magnificent biblioteca, España, because it was donated by the country of Spain to the city of Colombia. And it's this modern, it looks like a Frank Gehry building at the top, which is a public library. And it's the most amazing symbol, but it's a city that in 25 years, which is by urban trends a really short period of time, has a great economy, has everybody employed. It's now a place where Hewlett-Packard, Kimberly-Clark, Unisys, and other things have moved their South American headquarters to Medellin. Because of this listening to the voice and solving the problem of the people with some cool things. So, go to Medellin.
Any other general comments? We're running close to 10:20, so we're about 10 minutes to closing time. I just mentioned that in case you were burning to say something you haven't been able to say it yet. If not, we'll go back to questions.
Ready? Back to questions.
Questions, okay.
Thank you all. These are like
great questions.
Amazing, but there's a pile of them.
Yeah, in housing first efforts, how is space land acquisition addressed, especially in highly desirable areas? In housing first efforts, how is space and land acquisition addressed in highly desirable areas?
I guess that's a problem. So we've seen a shift in the federal policy towards a housing first model, and localities have picked up that perspective of housing people first and not worrying about whether someone's housing ready, but getting them into housing and worrying about social services afterwards. I think the problem is that they've moved to this sort of policy shift, but you're right, it's really hard to develop new housing, and the housing isn't there yet, and so they've moved to this shift, And I see a lot of local governments using that we're only doing housing first as a reason not to do the types of things I'm talking about in terms of intermediate solutions to get people off the street and into a place where they can have a sense of privacy, stability, and safety. And so that's an issue. How do you develop a large amount of housing?
I'm not sure what this means, but I'll read exactly. What role does privately owned public space have in the urban environment?
Very, very briefly. I'm not my area of expertise, but I've been exposed to this whole concept. And it's super interesting to me because basically what we're looking at are pockets of really beautiful spaces that could be used to community purposes that happen to be privately owned, but that can easily be made publicly available. And I guess on one hand, it requires the vision of the owner to say, this makes a lot of sense. And I've seen, and again, I'll use an example, I think many cities around the world, around the US at least, have this kind of thing. But San Francisco, you actually could just Google publicly owned private space San Francisco, and they have a walking map with something like 50 different, in downtown San Francisco, 50 different publicly owned private spaces, which generally tend to be, in my experience, because I did the whole walking tour, a commercial office building that has a public courtyard that actually, if you just read the fine print, it's available to anybody, but nobody knows it. And so lo and behold, it's a wonderful place to have lunch. It's a wonderful place to just go and have some quiet time. You are subject to the rules of that private property. So you can't go there and have a party as you might be able to in a public park. But nonetheless, these are little oases. And especially for people who might not have any easy access to green space in their home, for example, it's a gem. And I think what's required is the vision and the leadership of the owners, but also partnering with public agencies to come up with things like little walking play, just little tidbits. It's a downloadable brochure on a city-based website. You can go and do that. But, I'm not aware of any kind of inventory of these spaces, and that's kind of where you want to start, because they do exist, but they're going to look different based on the zoning and the codes of each city. And then it's a matter, though, of those owners saying, hey, this would actually be of immense public benefit, come at zero or extremely little cost to the owner, and go from there.
Yeah. Bill Paley, who was the original founder of CBS, created the first of those parks. It was Paley Park, and it's a tiny little park in the East 60s in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And it's peaceful and quiet. I think the disconnect is if everybody knows about it, it's no longer peaceful and quiet. But the ones I'm familiar with are the result of philanthropy and vision, as you say, but very little known.
The additive quality of tech startups, how does this affect a livable city?
Oh, that's a great question. It has, and again, where you see a city that has leapfrogged and has gone to, and again, in the developing world, there are places where everybody has a cell phone, and you sort of say, you're too poor to have a cell phone, but no, actually everybody has a cell phone. But the places, there's a section in Accra in Ghana that is very, very high tech, and everything is done electronically. They were so far ahead on the Apple Wallet, and they do everything that way, but that's because they never had to make the investment in the infrastructure. There are no lines. Boston's a great example. 28 loop around Boston.
Having an entrepreneurial community, a startup scene, anything along those lines, in my experience, it is invariably a great thing. Now, we're looking globally. I'm not going to talk about how a super, super developed tech ecosystem can lead to housing affordability issues and so on and so forth, but I'm saying at a very basic level. How many cities around the world are hungry to attract and cultivate an entrepreneurial ecosystem? Because not only does that attract younger people, new ideas, fresh energy, et cetera, but the whole space of civic innovation, entrepreneurial, you name it, it's a mindset shift for the way that we can develop thriving cities. So I'm just going to mention this, and I start to say full disclosure, I'm an advisor to the company, so take whatever that is. But part of why I'm attracted to it is because it's looking at some of this where you've got a lot of cities around the world that might have a startup or two, but nothing like an ecosystem, and they really struggle to attract the talent. They can't source the talent locally to build some of these businesses. So as a result, they end up either having to move to another city where they have that. You see this in Europe, like everyone has to end up or ultimately move to London or Berlin because they can't find what they need locally in their small town in Portugal or whatever. But it happens in Africa, it happens in South America. I connected with this company a few years ago called Jabatical. Now, as you might think, job plus sabbatical, specifically looking at tech startups and creative startups, and what they're trying to do is help tackle that brain drain by taking, well, as I like to say, imagine that you've always wanted to live in Thailand or visit Thailand, and either you can't afford to just up and live in Thailand for a year, or your idea of a year in Thailand isn't to spend that time on the beach. You actually want to contribute your skills. And so what they're now doing is doing one-year placements with tech talent in startups around the world to help build some of these ecosystems. You go for a one-year thing, you earn a local income, maybe get some equity in the company, and come back. I don't want to focus on the platform per se, but it's the kind of thing, so they have been inundated by requests. It is invariably something that cities want to build, that entrepreneurial ecosystem. Harder to do than one might think, and yes, ultimately you also want the funding ecosystem and this and that and the other, but it is a good thing. It is harder to do than you might imagine, but there are new platforms and initiatives popping up around the world that are starting to thread together when you've got talent in one place but you actually need it elsewhere. And the goal ultimately, I think, is to create a network of those cities that actually have that kind of ecosystem in place.
Eric, I'm going to ask you a question. You've been too quiet.
Very unusual.
In guns, in guns, germs, and steel, the geopolitical view of the earth, cities and civilizations thrived where there was a river, where there was a port, where there was food because of agriculture, and those are the cities that position themselves for success. My clients in Egypt were telling me a year before the Arab Spring that there was huge problems brewing in Egypt. And I said, politically? He said, no. Economically, because the food supply, Russian wheat, Australian agriculture was failing, and there wasn't enough wheat in storage houses in Egypt, and that this was going to blow up. And Syria was the breadbasket of the Middle East. But then no rain came, so it dried up, and millions of farmers moved into the cities with no job and became vulnerable to terrorists. And so all this migration that's happening due to weather is affecting a livable city. Any comments?
Yeah, there's plenty more to come. As sea level rise in the next 80 years, it's going to displace a couple hundred million people from coastal regions. So that's a lot of migration because people are still moving in droves to coastal areas and ignoring the future. Even if we're environmentally perfect now, sea level is going to keep rising for hundreds of years to come. We've committed in the warming we already have to melting ice sheets in Greenland, Antarctica. Mountain glaciers won't exist anymore by the end of the century. So I think that it's, and you've seen recently in the West the drought here that's just been broken in California. But those cycles exist through the ages, and it's likely that they will continue to get worse, actually. The water cycle on the planet is accelerated in a warming world, and so droughts will be drier, and wet regions are going to get wetter, and all of these things are, can be built into our thinking.
Okay, we are exactly at the end of this panel, and we have to vacate this as other people will be coming in for another session. Thank you very much for attending this.